Good afternoon. So I'm going to do exam review today. I will cover what you asked me to cover. I will not cover other things, so please tell me what topics you'd like me to talk about and I'll collect the list. If there's no topics, we can just leave now. So address splitting, okay.
I think there are other concepts that are covered in the exercises Thursday and Tuesday, but I forget the exact names of those exercises.
Well, I need some description. Okay, back there.
You go over 1-3 on last year's one, or last period.
1-3? 1-3 on spring 28, which is about. Okay, and virtual addresses. Okay, other things we need to talk about. Profilers, okay? Any other topics? That's all we got. Everyone's real happy. Okay. Well, we'll ask again later, but they said, if you don't have anything you want to talk about. Yeah. Q4 on, you'll need to be more specific because there are multiple versions of the exam. Okay, so pointers, this is pointers and arrays, again, and pointers and arrays. And you say question 4 and what variant of this?
Variant
E? Okay. What? G. Okay. Yeah. Page table sizes. Okay. Calculating page table sizes. Okay. User versus kernel mode? Okay. Yeah. Okay, can you be more specific?
No.
Okay.
You
mean the spring 2018 exam? Oh, okay. Oh, yes. Okay. Yes.
It gave us a bunch of copies of cache, and then said, what is the average memory access time?
Okay. So average memory access time. Yeah. Okay.
And
can you be more specific?
The question from the last exam, where it had like four loops, and then message
key. Question. Same. Okay. Anything else? No, I'll see. So why don't we cover pointers and arrays first? So I'll take Q1 on spring 2018. Files. So if I pull up spring 2018 exam. Oh, okay. Spring 2018 Q1 is not pointers and arrays, but pointers, array, and assembly. So spring 2018 Q1 is asking what says that we got a, is it saying we have a long star X, which is in R8, and we have a long Y, which is in R9, and we want to do X, Y plus 1 plus equals Y, and we're asking which of several options this is equivalent to. So one thing that might be helpful is what do we need to actually do to implement this instruction, and this is going to, this is equivalent to X plus Y plus 1 plus equals Y. So we're going to need to access memory at this location. This is a memory location, and we're going to take the address in X and add size of what X points to times Y plus 1. So remember, Y plus 1 is an integer, whereas X is a pointer. So we, to add to a pointer, we take the size of the thing it points to and add, go by that main, that unit. So we in fact need to scale, to find the address, we need to scale by something related to the size of the thing pointed to. And we need to add Y to that. So there are several options, and something to observe is that this memory location here is going to be, in terms of our registers, if we just rewrite that, is sort of star R8 plus 8 times R9 plus 1. I guess I'll use a X to distinguish from pointer dereferencing, which is going to be dereferencing R8 plus 8 times R9 plus 8. And if we remember our assembly syntax, we had offset base index scale, which turns into basically dereferencing offset plus base plus index times scale. And if we rearrange that this a little here, we can make it match this format better and get 8 plus dereferencing 8 plus R8 plus R9 times 8 and match that. So a way of specifying this memory address X at Y plus 1 in assembly is going to be 8, R8, R9, 8. And it turns out that one of the options is option A for this question is add R9 to 8, R8, R9. Okay, so questions about there, and probably if you're figuring out the exam question, you go the other way around and say, what address is this instruction accessing, and find out that it's the same as the address you computed, rather than rearranging it to match. No questions about this? So then we have pointers in array, so exam 1G. Let's see if I have convenient access to exam 1G. In theory, it looks like I do. Oh, right, and even can put it up on the wrong screen. Okay, so this was question 4 here, and this was asking, given that we had star R5 equals So we had some array of character pointers, and might help to think about this, that this is equivalent to doing, is the same as doing, having a temporary char star for each of the elements, and then setting an array to point to all these temporary pointers. That might help reason about what's going on here. That the axes look like a two-dimensional array, but that's not the sort of thing which is going on. And it asks, and we had, so which were true? So we had A, where we had star, R plus 4 plus 3, question equals R2 of 0. So if we figure out R2 of 0, this is the same as, so I'll do each side separately. So for this, we have star R plus 4 is going to be, so we have these different pointers. So originally, this is R array, the unincremented array plus 0, and array plus 1, and then plus 2, plus 3, plus 4. So this is society, the constant society, which we need to reference in at 3. Right. So this is a pointer to society, sorry. So a pointer to society, which we need to reference in at 3, 2. So R plus 0, point is a pointer to pointer. So there. Zero is a char star. And we're asking whether it equals, and this is equivalent to array 2, 0, which is equal to in at 0. And element 0 of in is I, and here we're taking of society is 3, and this gives us, so if we shift over this pointer to the string over by 3, we get ID. And when we dereference that, we get the single character that's there. We don't get the whole string because we're dereferencing it down to a char. So we get I, and that's why those are equal. Questions on what I did there? Are there other ones of these options here that you want me to go over, or is this procedure, going over this procedure for, so who thinks going over this was for A is enough and I don't need to go over B and C? Not. So, sorry, yeah. That I have a pointer, I don't have the address of the string, I have a pointer to the address of the string. And that's because if we think that, let's say this is at address one, address 10, this will be like 0x18, 0x20, 0x28, 0x30. What I have here is going to be 0x30. I have the address of that pointer, not the actual pointer. So this is a memory location in the array. It's not, which I'm representing in that shorthand. I guess I'll go, there seems to be some, go over one more. Okay, that's fine. So which is this one plus one equals star one plus three. So here, I'll take this side first. So dereferencing the array is the same as getting the element zero of the array. So it's, we're taking the pointer, in this case, 0x10, and dereferencing it. So this gives us the string we, which we add one to, and then dereference. And when we add one to it, we shift it over. So now we have a pointer to e, null character, and this gives us the character e. So r is equivalent to star r plus 0, which is equivalent to r 0, is one way of thinking about that. Is that that's the rule, this is the rule for what array indexing is. So we can work in both directions to deal with expressions that look kind of like array indexing. So here, on the other side, we have array of 1, which is liv plus 3. So liv is a pointer to L followed by I followed by V in memory. When you advance that by 3 characters, we get a pointer to E. We dereference that, we get the E that it points to and not the rest of the string. So questions? And I'll try to cover this in what I was going to take topics in rough order. We cover them in the class. So average memory access time. So the average memory access time is equal to the hit time when we have a. So the way of thinking about this is that if we have a memory access, that this is the amount of time it takes. So one way of thinking about this is it's going to be equal to the portion of time we have a hit times the amount of time for a hit plus the portion of time we have a miss times the amount of time for a miss. And in the question, I believe that this wrote this, we talked about the miss penalty. So the portion of time we have a hit is known as the hit rate, and the amount of time for a hit is known as the hit time. And the portion of time we have a miss is known as the miss rate, which is equal to 1 minus the hit rate, just because it's either a hit or a miss, not both, not neither. And the thing we multiply is known as the miss time, but that's not what this question gave you. The question gave you the miss penalty, because remember, on a miss, we do the same thing we would do. We try to get a hit, but then we spend some additional time known as a penalty because we didn't have a hit. And that's what the question gave you in this case. It gave you the miss penalty. So you need to still include the hit time because the idea is we try to get a hit, we find out there was no hit, and only then would we go on to do more work because we had a miss. Because we don't always go to memory just in case. We don't have enough time to do that in our caches. So I think that was one of the things which confused people in this question. And the other was we talked about the effect on instructions, and you know, if this was the only cause of stalling, then the amount of, then a way of thinking about it is that, you know, so cache effect on stalling is if cache is the only cause of stalling, then hits are free. Hits are free. That when the average memory access time is equal to the hit time, you know, so AMAT equals hit time, that means no stalling. And everything above that is time that we're wasting on instructions in order to stall. So you can figure out sort of what the average time we stall. So the average cycles of stalling is equal to the AMAT minus the hit time, or minus the hit time, because this is the average amount of time we have to wait. And if you look at the formula, you'll observe with, so I guess we'll continue expanding this formula. So here I have hit rate times, so here if I do some algebra, I get hit time plus 1 minus hit rate times miss penalty, or hit time plus miss rate times miss penalty. And if we consider the average memory access time minus the hit time with some algebra, we figure out that, oh, this is the miss rate times the miss penalty, is the average cycle of stalling. Another way of thinking about this is we have miss rate portion of the time, we have to do some stalling, and we spend the miss penalty is the amount of time we spend each of those times. And so that gives us our average cycles of stalling. This, and probably one of the more common errors in looking at that is not thinking that, oh right, we already have some time in our memory stage to account for a cache hit. That we always have that time allocated for every instruction, even if it's not accessing memory, to account for a cache hit in our pipeline processor. Is there questions about that? Yeah.
This assumes that the time and miss penalty are given in terms of cycles rather than physical time.
Yes. Yeah. So if we gave you the miss penalty in terms of actual like nanoseconds, and we didn't tell you how long the cycle time is, you just don't know what to do, right? Because you could imagine one solution is, I never went to stall, so I'm just going to make my cycle time long enough for a cache miss. That would probably be a bad idea, but that would be a possible solution. So we need something, you need some information which prevents that. But generally, what we've seen in our memory stages, they've been designed so the idea is when there's a hit, that's the amount of time we set them for, based on. It's assuming we always have hits, and misses are hopefully rare enough that we don't, that we shouldn't count for them in our cycle time and so on. Okay, so other questions? Okay, so the cache blocking question from the last exam. I need to pull up the correct exam. Okay, so if I find where the cache blocking question is, and I assume people mean the actual cache blocking question. So in this question, we had the question asked about the number of misses we had. And the observation is that the general structure was what was typical for our thing, is that for I equals 0 to 4, so on, for j equals 0 to 4, and so on, we do something with it ends up m row j column I and K, row I, column J. Row I, J to J plus one, I to I plus one, and one, J plus one. So an observation we can make is that and given we had a fully associative cache which can store 8 array elements, we can store 8 array elements with 2-byte blocks, which meant we had exactly enough space for. So this is 2-byte blocks. So this would be 2 cache blocks because each cache block held 2 elements. 2-byte blocks, each array element is 1 byte, and odd and even pairs of odd plus even same cache block. So this was 2 cache blocks exactly for here, and this was 2 cache blocks here. So that's exactly enough to fit in the cache. So we know that within this innermost loop, we're going to have at most 4 cache misses. And it's at most 4 because there's 2 cases. Either these 2 cache blocks we need for both the M, that message in the full thing, I'm just shortening it for the notes, and K, the key, are either already in the cache, in which case it's free, or we're going to bring them in once, and they're not going to be anything else we're accessing, which is going to take them out of the cache during that operation. So that gives us the best case of, well, this ended up going up to 8, so 6. So we had 2 cache blocks, so we had 2 blocks, 2 times, so we have 4x4 loops, so we have 4 times 4 times 4 as sort of our maximum, which gives us 64 maximum. This turned out to be the answer. So the question we need to answer to figure out whether we maybe saved a few extra is, was there any case where we have these 2 cache blocks here and we access them again in the next iteration? And if we look at how these loops work, there isn't. And the easiest way to see that is when we access row J, column I, and M, we're never going to access it again. So we can't have reuse between these different blocks. So we don't have, so we can't get lower than that 64, and that's how you got the answer of 64. So questions on explanation? Maximum, equal to minimum, because when we access M of X for once, we don't access it again. Access that block again. Yeah.
And the reason behind 4x4 is because the inner loop is 4 times,
and then you multiply by 4x4. The thing I'm marking with stars has happened 16 times for 16 different I, comma J. That's what the 4x4 is for. That makes sense? So the reason I know it can miss up to 4 times is because there's 4 distinct blocks, and I know the cache can hold all of those four blocks all at once, and there's nothing else I'm accessing. So I'm gonna definitely, so I have to miss, you know, I might have to bring in all of those four blocks into my cache, but once I do that, I know that there's nothing else that can possibly be in my cache, so all the other accesses to those blocks will be hits after that. Other questions? So next on this, okay, so I'll probably, again, doing things in roughly the order from class. So exceptions are, as used in this class, these are not try-catch. This is not try-catch in this class. This is way for the processor to run the OS when the OS needs to run. It needs to run. We talked about several different reasons for this. So because a user program did something bad, because a user program requested the OS to run, which is a system call, where the user program deliberately made a request, because some IO device had something happen, like e.g. a key press, and the OS might need to handle that. And we had a third reason, which is because something is terribly wrong with the hardware, and the OS should maybe try to recover. And our textbook had terms for each of these. This was a fault. This was a trap. In our textbook's terms, as I mentioned, these are not generic terms. You'll find other people using these words differently, but I'm providing these names so you can more easily follow the textbook with these notes. This was an interrupt in our textbook, and this was an abort. So that's what exceptions are. So context switching is the idea is that when the OS gets to run, the OS doesn't, when the OS finishes running, it can be running something else. So an example is I'm running an infinite loop on portal.cs.virginia.edu. You want to have your benchmark program actually run on that. The OS decides from a timer going off and triggering an interrupt. I guess I should have that here. That I don't deserve to run anymore. So it says, your program, nope. And it switches to another program, like your benchmark, and actually runs it. And that's a context switch. And to implement this, OS needs to save what was in CPU registers, etc. So CPU registers, page table base register, which we learned about, so it can keep running my infinite loop later and needs to restore the CPU registers, etc., of the program that it's running instead. Instead, assuming, it's not just starting new. And that whole process is a context switch. Yeah. So the question is, does context switching take a long time? And this depends on what you consider a long time and what operating system you're talking about. So the time for the actual operation of changing the CPU registers and the page table base register and returning from exceptions is not too long. I don't know what a good rough estimate for a modern machine is. I would guess like the direct time is something like probably like order 50, 100 nanoseconds. But the main cost of a context switch is typically from caches. That after a context switch, the way we learned about TLB is after a context switch, the TLB is empty. And if that's the case, if the TLB has to be empty because you don't have process IDs in the TLB, then most of your cost of the context switch is actually doing all that filling the TLB up. And even if you do have that, those TLB entries, you'll have a similar problem with the L1 cache, that the L1 cache has all this data for the program that used to be running and not the new program, and you'll have all this cost from filling in the cache with the program you just switched to. And that's where most of the cost of the context switch is, and when people try to measure that, I've seen numbers which are in the tens of microseconds or more. And it depends on the program. Like if your program relies on filling the entire cache, then you're gonna have a bigger context switch. You'll notice context switches more, because they're gonna make it so you get less of that cache in effect. Okay. So user versus kernel mode. That you want to share programs between different users, share machines between different users. Different users can't trust user programs to not do things they aren't supposed to, access the disk. Access the disk to read files for other users, or just not have bugs that corrupt other programs' memory, and so on. So we want to make sure that both malicious things won't happen and accidental things won't happen. And so we want some way of limiting what programs do. And so the hardware support for this support is 1-bit, which is user or kernel mode. Kernel mode. In user mode, we'll start with that. Kernel mode, more things work. So special instructions like change the exception table, change how exceptions are handled, or change the page table, base register, and so on work, like access IO device. And also, page table entries marked kernel mode only work. In user mode, all of those things cause an exception, run the OS and have the OS figure it out instead. So that's the central idea, is that the idea is that you can run normal programs in this user mode where they can't access dangerous functionality, either functionality which we want to restrict malicious users from getting at other users' files, or just preventing a bug in our program from breaking all the other programs on the system. So we make it so those things run the OS instead, and the OS can do something like crash the program rather than letting the program corrupt the memory for every other user. And the way this works with exceptions is that exception handlers always run in kernel mode, and normal code returning from exception handler switches back. Typically, switches back to user mode. And a consequence of this is that if we want to do something that needs a privileged instruction, e.g. changing the page table base register or accessing an IO device, need to cause an exception to do this, because otherwise we won't enter kernel. Yes?
Is this still, we have the exception handlers always been kernel, only handle exceptions in the places that we have exceptions for, not traps.
So by exception handlers, I mean all kinds of exception handlers, regardless of the type of exception. So if it's a fault, trap, all the types, they all run in kernel mode. If you want to have a user program figure out what to do for an exception, the way that works is that you'll have an exception handler that's part of the OS, and it will switch back to the user program you want to handle it. Which is something like Linux does, for example. Or can't supports doing. Yeah.
When you do
C.
CN.
Like
in C++,
CN, that so the question is, does CN use a system call? Yes, eventually, to get something from the keyboard, we have to use a system call somewhere. So it's not a one-to-one correspondence, so it's not necessarily the case that every time you call CN, it uses a system call, but some part of the process had to use a system call to get the data. Other questions? Okay, so address splitting. So we've talked about a whole bunch of ways of splitting up addresses for various purposes this semester. So let's go over that. I'm going to start with the first one we talked about, I think the first one, which is for caches. For caches, we took our address. We have our physical address, because remember, all the caches we dealt with, we're really thinking about physical addresses, and we split that up into a tag, an index, and an offset. And the idea is the tag is to, so the tag is different things stored in the same set. Which one is it? Which one do we have? That's what the tag is for. So we have different blocks that go to the same set. Which one do I have? The index is which set do I use for this value? I use lookup store this value. And the offset is where in a multi-byte block is this value? And I guess I'll go next to TLBs, because TLBs are a type of cache. But TLBs, rather than looking up a physical address, we look up a virtual page number. And we split it up into a tag and index. So the tag is, again, the tag and index is the same, work the same way. There's no offset, because I only store one thing, a page table entry per block. I don't need to say which of those things am I getting. There's only one to find. I don't need an offset, and will not have. Then we have for virtual memory, and we split up our physical address again into a physical page number and a page offset. And we also split up our virtual addresses into a virtual page number and page offset, which should be the same size, but probably isn't, because I'm bad at drawing, bad at ASCII art. Okay, so, and the page numbers are which, so the virtual page number is which index into the process's memory that the memory a user program thinks it has, or may at, which index of page size chunks, and page offset is where in that chunk, and the physical page number is which index of page sized chunks in the hardware's memory. Do I, am I going to? So for, so these are our different splitting, and for determining, for doing the splitting, the main thing you have to do is you have to know how many bits do I use for each of these things. So for the cache, the offset is the offset bits is enough bits to identify the byte. So if we have k byte blocks, this means we have log 2 of k bits. For the index bits, it's enough bits to identify the set. If we have k sets, we have log 2, I guess I'll use capital S sets, we have log 2 of s bits for the index. And the same works for the TLB, and the tag is everything that's left over. And the same is going to be true here for the TLB. The tag is everything of the virtual page number, which is what we look up in the TLB, that's left over. For virtual memory, the page offset is enough bits to identify a byte in a page. So if we have n byte pages, this means we have log 2 of n bits of page offset. And the virtual or physical page number is everything left over. And I guess some of the confusion with virtual memory is sometimes it's not, we don't give you quite the virtual, the address size information, but we tell you about page tables. So let's talk about how this relates to page tables. So a page table entry contains a physical page number, but let's go with a page table has one entry for each virtual page number, or for a single level table. Let's start with a single level table. An entry for each virtual page number. So that means that if I have e page table entries, then in a single level table that the virtual page number is log 2 of e bits. If I have a multi-level table, page table, then we divide up our virtual address into more pieces. So we take our virtual page number and our page offset. Probably just make this bigger. And we divide this up into a part one, part two, and so on. You know, where we use part one, index in first level table. Part two is the index in the second level table, and so on. And if we know that there are E1 entries in the first level table, then part one is log 2 of E sub 1 bits. So you could use that to figure out how big, you know, the virtual address is. If you know the size of each of the, know the number of entries in each level of the table, you can figure out the size of each of the parts, add that together, you get the virtual page number size, combined with the page offset that tells you the size of the whole virtual address. Yes?
Is the number of entries on the different levels usually the same?
So the question is, the number of entries in different levels usually the same? Generally, processor manufacturers try to make it the same, but sometimes you're in a situation where you can't really do that. For example, if you have 13-bit virtual page numbers, you probably can't make each level have the same number of bits. Yeah. So the question, how does a processor manufacturer determine the number of bits in each level? They can do whatever they like. The typical strategy I've seen is to make each page table be the size of a page, which you technically don't have to do. Each page table of the, starting with the last level, and do that for all the levels but the first one, and leave any leftover in the first, making the first page table smaller. That's what I've typically seen. I'm not sure that actually has an advantage over other strategies that still give you roughly the same size page tables.
Because in the memory they're all, just assume they're all one or one
different. Oh, the virtual page number parts, yes.
Yeah.
And that's, and you know that for the memory homework because we tell you the size of each page table. Yeah. Sorry? What happens when a page table has multiple pages? That just means we use the same procedure to figure out the address of the page table's beginning. So we're going to get a physical page number, that's going to be the beginning of the page table, and then we add the part of the virtual address times the page table entry size to that to figure out where that page table entry is. And the page table is multiple pages, that might happen to take us to another physical page, but that's fine. We still have a physical address, we still know how to access a physical address. And the OS just needs to figure out how to allocate a couple pages for those page names that are next to each other. So it's the same as one page. It's also the same as a single level table where we always have that situation. With a single level table, we have our starting address, and almost always with a big memory, we're going to have multiple pages of page table entries. I guess not in the memory homework, but in a typical scenario. Yeah. So the question is, I remember us multiplying by a page size when I did a multi-level page table. What was that about? So when we think of a page table entry, it contains a valid bit, a physical page number, and other metadata bits. So this is a physical page number. And to access a page table entry, we want a byte address. And we know the computation is that we take the, you know, start of table plus PTE size times index, you know, VPN part. And if we think of writing out what we're going to get here, let's say this physical page number is page number 0x123, and our PTE size is equals, say, 4, and our VPN part, you know, next, our next VPN part is, is 0x2. So VPN size is 4 bytes for a PTE, and this VPN part we can think of as saying, you know, PTEs into the table. And if we think about the units we have here, we're saying that page number 0x123 plus 4 bytes per PTE times 2 PTEs into the table, and you see that we have a unit matching problem here. That we're trying to add a page number to a number of bytes. Those are not compatible units, so we need to fix that. And so the way we fix that is we turn this page number into, and we convert it times page size, times bytes per page. You know, so this is page number, you know, we can think of this as number of pages after beginning of memory. So we're turning that into a byte number of bytes, 4 bytes of PTE times 2 PTEs from beginning of table. And when we do that, we end up having, oops, are multiplying by our page size and bytes, we end up having our units match up if you cancel out the units. And that's what that times page size correction is for. That makes sense? Okay. And I inadvertently talked about page table sizes. So page table sizes, so you have this relationship with number of VPN bits we use, which is all of them for the single level case, determines number of entries, also have page table entry size, usually we're told, but the minimum PTE size is enough to hold a valid bit plus a physical page number. Because that's definitely what we have to have in there, but we might have more stuff in there and need more space. And typically, we're going to want the page table entry size to be a power of 2, because that makes the hardware way, way simpler to actually do the page table lookup. So the virtual address on Spring 2018. Okay, so question 3. Okay, so question 3. So this is saying that we have a system, we have 256 byte pages, a 2-entry direct map TLB, and it gives us a list of memory accesses, which I'll write down as we go through that. First, let's figure out, if I have a virtual address, how does this work? So my virtual addresses are going to look as follows. I have my virtual page number and my page offset, my virtual address. And I know my page offset is going to be 8, because this is going to be 256 equals 2 to the 8 bytes. So that's enough to identify which byte in a page is that 8 byte page offset. And the virtual page number is everything left over. We don't actually get told how big the addresses are. And then we have to split our virtual page number into a tag and an index for the TLB. So our TLB tag is everything but one bit, and I'll just of the this, and we know it's one bit because this is which of two entries do we use? And remember, our TLB only takes in the virtual page number, so that's all we're going to use. So then we need to figure out how many TLB misses do we have. So we have our access to 0x04, so I'm just going to keep track of what's in the TLB. We have index 0, index 1, and what the virtual page number that entry is for is. So we access 0x0. So initially, we have nothing in the TLB. Then we access 0x0, and that's a miss because we didn't have it before. And we're going to bring that in, and the bit we want to check for the index is the low order bit of the third nibble in the hex digit, which I've highlighted here. So that's 0 in this case, so it brings it into index 0, so that's virtual page number 0, because remember, the top part of this address is the virtual page number. Then we access 0xFFF, and this is also a miss, and if we look here, it has a 1 in the bit we're checking, that single bit, which is the TLB index, so it goes in index 1, And the virtual page number is OX, is XF, or 15, so that we store the page table entry for virtual page number 15 in index 1 of our TLB. Then we access OX100. This is also a miss, and it's going to go in index 1 because it has a 1 in that bit, everything else is 0, so we replace what we just put in the TLB. Then we access OX101, and this is the same virtual page number that we just accessed, so it's going to be a hit. Because only the page offset of the address is different. Then we access OXFFE, and this is a conflict miss, that we accessed this page before, a different page offset, but we accessed the page before. But because we accessed page 1 in the middle, we don't have it in our TLB anymore, so it's a miss. And we bring that in, again, in index 1. So now we have page 15 replacing page, the TLB entry for page 1 being replaced by the TLB entry for page 15. And then we have OXFF6. This is a hit because, again, we're accessing virtual page 15, which we just brought into the TLB, so that will be a hit. And then we access OX0FF, which is the same thing we accessed at the beginning. That's a miss, or that's a hit, rather, because we've never used index 0, and it's still in there. So that's a different part of page 0, so we have the page table entry for page 0, so that's going to be still there from the very beginning when we brought it in with our first access. So, questions about what I did here? Yeah. So FFE is a conflict miss because maybe it would help if I wrote the VPN being accessed was here we accessed page 0, here we accessed page OXF, here we accessed the PTE for page OX1F. So we already accessed that page table entry. And it already had it in our TLB, but it was still a miss because we had run on something that mapped to the same set. So it's a conflict miss for the TLB. Make sense? Yeah. Yes, this is deliberately lined up in this way. Because we don't send any other part of the address to the TLB. It never sees it. So as far as the TLB is concerned, our hit here for address 1 is just that we're accessing the same thing again. The exact same thing you tried to access before as far as the TLB is concerned. So why doesn't the TLB use the offset bit? What are we looking up in the TLB? Page table entries. The page table's for all the possible offsets, so we don't care. So there's no point in sending it.
In the general cache, we have a
type of offset. Oh, so the question is, why don't we have an offset? So to have offset bits, that would mean we were storing blocks in the TLB of multiple page table entries. This is something I could imagine doing. I do not know of any processor which does it, and one possible explanation for this is that you might think, well, if it's worth putting multiple page table entries together, maybe I should just make my pages bigger. And that's probably why it doesn't happen. Other questions? Okay, so then about profilers. So profilers are, you know, time your code to find out where it is slow, i.e. where does it spend its time? You know, the big problem is we don't spend a lot of time optimizing something which takes 5% of your time. If you take your routine which takes 5% of your time and make it 10 times faster, congratulations, your program now runs very slightly faster. Hope that was worth writing all those vector instructions and reading the Intel manuals to get that extra 5% when you could have been spending time where your program's spending like 40% of your time. And the profilers, the way they work, there's sort of two designs. So one are the sampling-based profilers, which stop the program periodically, record where it is, and report to you, and have tool reports distribution of where it was stopped. So it takes samples of where your program is over its execution. That's the profiler I showed you. There's another sort of instrumentation-based design. Design which is modify code to have counters to count time how long each function or instruction, how often and long each function or instruction runs. Which is another type of profiler you might come across. I didn't use it on purpose because these tend to be less reliable. Mainly, but they give you better counts, they don't tend to give you worse times because there's more overhead to measure the times. But in either case, you get a report of what code was running, and also sometimes what code called the code that was running. Both of which are important because, for example, often the code that was running will be something like the memcopy function. And that's not actually very useful information unless you know why am I copying memory all the time. You probably are actually interested in what's calling memcopy, and that's where you'll do your optimization. Or another example from what I showed you is like the code that was running in my case was often the hash table implementation. And it's useful to know that, but I really care about what's calling it because that's the code I'm probably going to say, is there something faster than a hash table I can use for this? And any questions about this? So any other things people would like me to cover since I got to the end of my text file? Anything else should review? The question is, do I expect there to be time pressure? The final will be roughly twice the length of a normal exam. So you can infer whether 3 hours is enough for you for that, based on that idea. Yeah?
Can we go over, if we have time, the hash questions
from the previous exam, or just go to the hash questions? I can try to do that. We'll see if we run out of time. Remember which question that was. The correct exam. The last exam, not the draft final. So version A. Okay. Yes, so so the code here was I should look at the key. I wrote a little description. So the code was for i 0 to 3, 3 for J, 0 to 256. Do you want me to go over just the hard one?
Sure.
So, which is the other way around, array of I times 256 plus equals array of I times 256 plus J. So here, the key observation is that, and our cache was 512-byte direct mapped, 16-byte blocks, array, and elements are 1 byte. So key observation here is because we have a 512-byte cache, array of 0 and array of 0 plus 512 conflict, which means that array of 0 times 256 and array of 2 times 256 conflict. And similarly, it turns out that if you take 1, we take 256 and 3 times 256, that array of 1 times 256 and 3 times 256 also conflict in the cache. So on each iteration of this inner loop, we're going to, so if we only consider the array I times 256 at elements, even though we're accessing array 0 and array 1, which are in the same cache block, we don't actually get to take advantage of that because pesky array 2 evicts array 0, array 1, array 2, and so on, the rest of the cache block. So we don't actually get to take advantage of reuse, and the same is true in the other way. When we access array of 256 plus 1, we're not going to have reuse there. And so this means that we have a problem with these accesses not getting as much reuse as we might like. That even though we access array of 0 when j equals 0, we don't get to take advantage of having done that when j equals 1. We don't get to take advantage of having done that when j equals 2. I'm sloppy here. So let's go systematically through here. So all the accesses to this are going to be a problem because it turns out, you know, if we think of that as the first access, that it always conflicts when we go through the j loop. That when we access it for j equals 2, that's going to clear the value we had for j equals 0, which means the next time j equals 0, even if it happens to be the same, we're not going to still have it in the... When we access it for I equals 0 and I equals 2, those conflict. So we access j equals 0, I equals 0. We might think when I equals 1, it's still going to be there. It's not. So that means that these miss every time. Yeah.
So you're saying that 0, I 0, equals 2, with 2 would affect 0?
Yes, because we have that these two indices go to the same set of the cache. So accessing for I equals 2 evicts for I equals 0. So every time we run through all those three indices, we always have misses, even though we're accessing 0 and 286 and 512 and 768 over and over again, because they we have those pairs of conflicts among them, we're never going to have hits throughout this entire process. It doesn't affect zero, however, array of 3 times 256 ends up conflicting with that. So we always have a pair, a matching pair that evicts things. So those are all misses. Yeah.
I don't really have a pattern for this problem, but which, on like 1250, which side is that?
It doesn't matter in general. You don't know. The C compiler can do either thing. So you don't know. If we give a question where it matters, we made a mistake. So for this, we have the same issue for misses. That if we only consider this, if the loop only had those accesses, we have the same issue because, let's say, array of 8 and array of 512 plus 8 conflict. Or not 8, I should do 16, even though those are a different block than 0. But array of I times 256 and array of I times 256 plus j are in the same block if j is less than 16. So we have some hits because of that, because those are in the same block, but every other case is a miss, and that's how we got the answer for this question. Sorry for fumbling beginning, need to remember old questions. And that's what the red text on the key is trying to say. Going on. It's 2048 minus 64. Because we have 16 times 4 cases where j is less than or equal to 15 that aren't misses, and otherwise we have 2048 misses, 1024 for each of the two array accesses. And I guess we're kind of implicitly assuming that the plus equals is one access, which is probably something we should have been more explicit about. Or no, I guess we're not assuming it's one access, but we're assuming that it's done all at once so we don't have to worry about conflicts. But no, right, there's no conflicts in there. Yeah, never mind. There's no problem with the plus equals being more than one access because we know that if we read it, we can write it again without a miss. So, other questions? Okay, so I am all set. I will be posting these notes and see you on Monday. On Tuesday, when our exam actually is. I'm thinking of my other class, where I'm gonna see people on Monday.